Good evening. Thanks for joining us this evening as we open our fall exhibit for the libraries, Immigrant Lives in the OC and Beyond. I'm Jerry Munoff, the University Librarian. I'm glad to see you here. I want to mention just a few things about the campus and the libraries before we start our program. In spite of current budget difficulties, the campus has enrolled a record number of students yet again. We admitted 7,300 new students this fall, so we're now at a total enrollment of a little over 27,600 students, which is a record for us. It seems that every one of those students is in the library most every day, which is good. But the use of the libraries continues to grow and sets new records. Last year, we had over 2.2 million in-person visits to library buildings, and the online use of our resources and services continues to grow. Last year, we had 24 million hits on our online web pages, which keeps us very busy. To accommodate the growth of the students, we also continue to renovate our physical spaces. Last year, we completed renovations of the third and fourth floor in this building, Langston Library. And over the summer, the Gateway Study Center, which is another original campus building just across the plaza here, was renovated. We totally refurbished that with new paint, new carpet, expanded space, new furniture, new computers, refinished original woodwork. And it's that's our building that's open till 3 a.m. most days. And it is packed until 3 a.m. most days, and all throughout the day, too. It also opens at 7 a.m. in the morning. The students like it very much. The returning students are, they're usually their first reaction is, wow, because the building hadn't changed much since the first days of campus. So it was a much overdue renovation, and we're going to continue to upgrade all of our library spaces because they continue to be used. To assist with the growth on campus and in the libraries, UCI has announced a $1 billion campaign that's now underway with the objective of broadening the university's teaching, research, and public service to the people of California and beyond. The libraries have a key role to play in the campaign as the foundation of the campus's intellectual strength and innovation for learning and research across all disciplines on campus. The campaign for the library will focus on three priority areas: the enhancement of the library's collection services and public outreach, growth of our staff and facilities, and expansion of our information technologies. And you'll be hearing more from us about the campaign as it goes along. Tonight, our new exhibit examines the lives of immigrants in Orange County and beyond. It was inspired by pioneering research on immigration being conducted by leading UCI faculty, including tonight's speaker, who have established the campus as a national leader on the topic. They're taking multiple disciplinary approaches to the study of immigration and its many aspects, legal, economic, social, cultural, and political, to better understand the very complex issues and inform our society, communities, and governments. And while we didn't hear much about immigration during the presidential campaign, I suspect that it's going to continue to be of great interest to the nation and certainly to California. Most of the materials on exhibit are from the library's rich research collections. And some were generously donated by the curator and some UCI faculty authors. The library's collections on immigration are rich and include not only thousands of books and journals and multimedia items, but also provides access to research data from contemporary surveys on immigrants. For example, the library provides access to a recent survey conducted in a study of immigration and intergenerational mobility in the LA metro area, conducted by a team of six UCI researchers. Our exhibit curator is Daniel Sang, who's UCI Research Librarian for Asian American Studies, Economics and Political Science, and Social Science Data. The quality of the exhibit speaks to his high expertise and knowledge on that subject. And where did Dan end up? Dan's at the back of the room. Thank you, Dan, for your great work on the exhibit. Our speaker tonight, and I'm very pleased he had time in his busy schedule to fit us in, is Dr. Frank Bean, who is Chancellor's Professor of Sociology and Economics and Director of the Center for Research on Immigration, Population, and Public Policy. He is noted internationally as an expert on immigration, and his current research focuses on the implication of U.S. immigration policies, Mexican immigrant incorporation, the implications of immigration for changing race and ethnicity in the United States, the determinants and health consequences of immigrant naturalization, and the development of new estimates of unauthorized immigration and emigration. Prior to joining the UCI faculty, Frank was at the University of Texas at Austin as the Ashbel Smith Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs, Director of the Population Research Center, and Chair of the Department of Sociology. Frank doesn't like to hold only one position at any given time, I think. Previously, he was at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. as the founding director of both the Program for Research on Immigration Policy and the Population Studies Center. He's a member of Phi Beta Kappa, Phi Kappa Phi, and the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as a past recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. He has also been a visiting scholar at the Australian National University and the American Academy in Berlin and the Russell Sage Foundation, as well as distinguished visiting senior visiting professor at CCIS and the Center for U.S.-Mexico Relations at UC San Diego. So I'd like to welcome Frank Bean. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, and thank all of you for coming tonight. 6 months ago, this would have been a great topic, immigration and immigration policy, and how the United States is going to cope with that in an election year, and how a new administration would cope with that. Now, it's way on the back burner because it's the economy, which is something we'll get to. I didn't realize there were going to be so many historians in the audience. My wife is a historian, sitting right down here, so I'm going to do a rather superficial run-through of immigration history that I'm sure all the historians, especially the American historians, will find lacking and wanting. Much of these remarks are based on a couple of papers that I've worked on with a couple of colleagues. Both of them, one is Jim Bachmeyer, right here, another is Susan Brown, who's over here, so they deserve all the credit for everything that's good, and I'll take the blame. The main point that I want to try to draw our attention to is that throughout most of our history, and we'll see that it's run in cycles as far as immigration is concerned, immigrants have served a useful purpose in American society, mostly economic, to some extent nation building. Immigration has not been without considerable stresses and strains, as we're all familiar with, and we'll comment on a little as we go through some of this. But for the most part, despite these stresses and strains, the country sought immigrants, it accepted immigrants, it may have wanted to put them through a few acid tests before they were fully accepted into the society, but in many parts of the country at different times they were even granted citizenship immediately upon arrival, not in a formal sense, but in a de facto sense, allowed to vote, participate, sometimes hold office, etc. In recent years, I think we have created a rather different kind of context and environment vis-a-vis immigrants, and that's the major point that I would like to make, and then talk about what that means as far as immigration policy is concerned, particularly given the current economic context. So why do we think of the United States as a nation of immigrants, and why do we view this for the most part in positive terms? I think there are a number of reasons. One, as we've already indicated, immigration and nation building have gone hand in hand for much of U.S. history. The country actively sought settlers in many instances, maybe didn't always welcome people after they got here as warmly as they might have, but nonetheless, the immigrants came and they served a purpose. Through the Land Grant Act and other pieces of legislation, much of the country adopted a small farm model, both to attract immigrants and settlers and to foster egalitarianism in the United States. This, I think, has generated a positive reaction about immigration. I think there's also sort of a spurious correlation. The rise of the U.S. during the 19th century to become the leading industrial power in the world, I think, which involved a substantial role played by immigrants, also kind of created an impression, I think, that immigration and prosperity and manifest destiny and many other things kind of went hand in hand. And the early immigrants for much of the early history of the country came from a variety of different countries, all European in the beginning, but still different countries, many different religious backgrounds, and I think this promoted religious tolerance at both individual and institutional levels. The five major waves of immigration, then, I've roughly cataloged here and given names. You know, the original colonial period, the coerced migration involving African origin slaves, which brought the largest wave of newcomers to the country in the 17th century. Agrarian settlers in the 1800s, especially the mid-1800s. A wave that I've called urban industrial laborers in the early part of the 20th century. And then after 1965, persons who were came mostly for family reasons and lots of refugees. It's useful, I think, to look at each of these in a little bit more detail. But here's a graph that shows these waves. The data on the African origin slaves are sketchy, and so it's a little hard to put them in the chart, and they can't be viewed in exactly the same terms as other immigrants for whom we have much better statistical series. But if you look at the first wave, which were the early colonial persons, which peaked in the late 1700s, as high as almost 90 persons per thousand were coming in any given year, immigrants in any given year. But it goes up and down, corresponding to the various waves. In the end, I want us to try to think a little bit about where we are now and what the future might hold as far as immigration is concerned. The colonial period, of course, consisted mostly of English, but some Dutch and Germans. Persons were pushed out of England in the continent by poverty and pulled, so to speak, into the New World by promises of religious freedom and availability of land. And England just found the United States a convenient dumping ground for paupers and felons. And it didn't take too long for the country to react negatively to that and to seek some pieces of legislation that would promote more desirable entrants. The early African origin migrants in Virginia were initially indentured servants who were forced into a longer period of servitude than other indentured servants, which the plantation owners in the state found convenient and gradually converted that into slavery, which became a practice that spread throughout the South, serving the interests of the large plantations and agricultural growers conveniently. It's interesting to note that slavery was not an isolated Southern phenomenon, but involved really a complicated set of trade relations throughout the entire Atlantic, involving New England and Britain and the slave trade in Africa and the Southern plantation owners. Its existence in the South also, through cotton growing, enabled the rise of the textile industry in New England. The third wave in the 1800s provided settlers from, again, Britain to some extent, but also Northern European, Scandinavian countries, Northern Germany, and the Land Grant Act and the Homestead Act and the small farm model were enticements that were actively sold throughout Europe by U.S. consuls and various states in the country who sent representatives to these consuls in order to recruit settlers. And if persons could get 160 acres in return for 5 years of working the land and a declaration of intent to become a citizen. This, I think, is an interesting example of the cementing of the relationship between migration and citizenship. And many of these persons were considered and treated as apprentice citizens from the moment they arrived. Again, not without considerable stresses and strains and turmoil and conflict in many instances, but it was expected that even though people might be weird, different, hard to get along with, not speak English, what have you, that they were going to become United States citizens, and as I said, many instances were allowed to vote, to hold office, etc., particularly in this Midwestern expansion. Very different from the situation we have today. That was largely a rural farm phenomenon. The next big wave occurred as the United States industrialized, with the railroads providing access to markets throughout the country. By the end of the 19th century, the United States was the leading industrial power in the world. And this industrialization, most of it urban, required large numbers of immigrants and laborers for the burgeoning factories that were that had emerged. The new arrivals were different, still from Europe, but mostly southern and eastern southern and eastern Europe, mostly Catholic or Jewish, and not as well received as the earlier migrants, perhaps in part because of their religious background, perhaps eventually in part because of global political conditions and the rise of Bolshevism in Russia. Many of the new workers were working class, and a backlash eventually emerged in efforts to restrict immigration, which led to the imposition in 1921 and implementation in 1924 of the so-called National Origin Quota Act, which was an effort to say that only persons could come to the country who'd come, in proportion to the countries they'd come from before, which meant that mostly Northern and Western Europeans would have been able to come. To some extent, the purposes, and that did lead to a strong slowdown in immigration, as you know, but mostly the Great Depression and World War II almost totally stopped immigration. And after World War II, that's the slide here. After World War II, the national origin quotas were still in existence, but they gradually became a kind of albatross to the geopolitical strategic purposes of the country in those days, fighting the Cold War, because they were discriminatory. They mostly provided basis only for Northern and Western Europeans to come to the country. And this was kind of awkward when the United States was dealing with Cold War allies who were not Northern and Western European countries. During the Civil Rights era of the 1960s was another discriminatory feature of the society that civil rights advocates sought to overturn. And in fact, in 1965, the quotas were abolished. It was not thought that the abolition at the time, that the abolition of the national origins quotas would lead to much increase in immigration or to a drastic change in where immigrants came from. It was thought that things would kind of percolate along as they always had, but that's not what happened. Europeans stopped coming, in part because the strong economic development programs in Europe, supported to a considerable extent by the United States, and also the labor shortages in Europe as a consequence of the war, provided many economic opportunities there, and so there was little need for out-migration. Migrants did start coming, however, from Asian countries and from Latin American countries, particularly Mexico. The Mexican migration was a spin-off or spillover in part from the Bracero program. This Mexican migration has gone on for a long time, back into even the 19th century when the railroads were constructed. But the Bracero program in particular, which was set up in 1942 at the beginning of World War II to provide needed labor because of labor shortages during the war, provided a mechanism where workers could come in legally, but there were not enough of them as were needed. And so there was a demonstration effect there, and lots of other Mexican workers came as well, seeing their friends and relatives and so forth migrating. And then when the Bracero program was terminated in 1964, this process was well established and institutionalized. And it persisted in unauthorized form. But the migration the country has had for the last 30 years and has involved two or three key features. First, lots of family members joining persons who came, so that and this has built up over time. So it's mostly, you know, 80-85% Asian and Latin American the last 20 years. A second, very different from what was expected at the time the 1965 quotas were done away with. A substantial increase in what I call unauthorized migration, most of it from Mexico, because of labor demand and because the tradition of just accepting movement back and forth across the border, which had been a part of the American Southwest for centuries, gradually came to be viewed as something involving the need for state control. People familiar with the border, or at least 20 or 30 years ago, you know, are familiar with living on one side, working on the other side, back and forth, no problems, no significant issues. But as concern with this, that, or the other has risen, and as there has seemed to be a need to control this dynamic, the Border Patrol has gradually been built up. And an enforcement type approach to this has gradually taken hold such as now viewed as a major problem rather than some kind of natural back and forth movement. Anyway, the overall point that I think emerges when one looks at this, it is that most of these waves of migration have been, for the most part, accepted. As I said, many stresses and strains, much turmoil, sometimes conflict, but in general, the assumption that the persons who had come for one reason or another, for settlement, for agrarian frontier expansion, for work in the industrial labor centers, were going to become Americans and were Americans. They were viewed as apprentice citizens, as it were, and became citizens, both in a de facto and in a de jure sense. Recently, starting with, some would say, the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, which substantially expanded the enforcement role of the Border Patrol at the Mexican border. The 1996 legislation, both welfare reform legislation and that horribly long, complicated terrorist act name that I can never quite remember or get right, have put more strictures on immigration and on citizenship. For the first time, really, since early in the 20th century, welfare reform took away citizenship rights from immigrants. In other words, increasingly, we tell immigrants, you, the burden of proof now is on you. We don't treat you as if you are an incipient contributor, a participant in this society. We treat you and we see you as someone who has to pass a test. You have to prove your worth before you can join our collectivity. That, I think, is a different orientation toward immigrants fundamentally than one that has existed throughout most of our history. Why is that important? What's important about that, I think, is that for reasons, new reasons, of demographic change, we are in a situation where we probably need immigrants as much or more than at any time in our history. And going through these various waves of immigration that we've talked about, we can see that we have needed settlers, we have needed workers, we have needed to accommodate refugees, we have needed and accommodate immigrants for a variety of different reasons. Now we are a different society demographically. Demography works its influence in mostly subtle and invisible ways. Our birth rate is down. Our life expectancy is mostly up. Our involvement of larger fractions of the population of the workforce is up, sometimes for reasons of necessity rather than choice. We have more old people to take care of. Except for our increased inequality the last 30 years, we also have a lot of affluence, which generates a lot of restaurant activity, a lot of tourist activity. We need a lot of hotel workers, a lot of childcare workers, a lot of old age workers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where are these workers going to come from? This is where I go back to my comments about the economy. It's sort of ridiculous to talk about these kinds of things, given where we are today in terms of the economy, which looks like certainly a recession deeper than any in the post-World War II era. Perhaps the threat of a deflationary kind of depression like occurred in the early 1930s And so the idea that the economy might be so strong and so robust as to need lots of workers doesn't exactly resonate, but I think that's where we were 6 months ago. And I think there's a high probability that's where we'll be again if we can get through this extremely tough spot that we're in right now economically. And it's fairly easy to demonstrate, I think, that during most of the last 25 or 30 years, except for the mild recessions that we have experienced, we've needed more workers than have readily been available. Now, that's we can get into some nuances about that, having to do with, well, if we paid better wages, we would have more workers and so forth. But the best, I think, indication of that was in the job market in the late 1990s. At the end, toward the end of the high-tech boom, when you know, there just weren't enough workers around, and for the first time in a long time, average wages for people at the bottom part of the income distribution actually started to go up. But part of the reason for this, and part of what's new, is this demographic change. You know, the birth rates don't seem likely to increase for a wide variety of reasons. Europe is experiencing a lot of the same sort of phenomena. Stories about elderly Italians needing workers to take care of themselves and so on and so forth. Sometimes I tell a little anecdote. How much longer should I go, Jerry? Not too much. Yeah. in any event, the last Congress considered a lot of legislation that was called comprehensive immigration reform that involved lots of different provisions. But what comprehensive fundamentally means is something that's a big enough umbrella to try to accommodate both, try to deal with both the workforce needs that we face, the large, about 12 million estimated, unauthorized population in the country now that can, in my view, only be dealt with through legalization and citizenship, and some way to provide for these workforce imperatives going forward. The biggest question advanced post-industrial societies face these days in this arena is immigrant integration, particularly in Europe, I think, because the gap, the cultural gap between European populations and many of the immigrant groups that have gone to European countries is at least as great or bigger than the United States faces. And for all of our many problems, and there are many, we have, for the most part, had a more dynamic and flexible economy and labor market than has existed in many instances in Europe, and have been somehow or other seemingly better able to cope with the accommodation of newcomers, at least in the economic sense. But how are we going to do this? How can one get immigration legislation that combines all of these things? I think the difficulty is best summed up by a comment that someone in Washington told me about 2 weeks ago, made by Birch Bayh, Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana, who's a friend of immigration reform. And the advocates who were talking to him were seeking his support, which he was inclined to give, but were also seeking his advice and his analysis of the situation. And he said, this is before most of the presidential campaign, and his comment was, I'm for all this. I think the country needs it. We've got to do something along these kinds of lines, but it's not easy for us to be generous to immigrants when so much of the rest of the population itself is badly hurting. And I think that sums up the dilemma we face. And that was 6 months ago. Things are hurting even more now. So, you know, if the economy does start to improve, and the lessons of the last several recessions are that the job market won't catch up to the improvement in the economy for 2 or 3 years, there's still going to be efforts to mount immigration reform, but it's going to be difficult to achieve, I think. And the dilemma is, how can we integrate newcomers that our economy needs when increasingly we view newcomers with skepticism and increasingly people are anxious about their own security as their pensions have become more precarious, their health care and their health insurance more precarious, their jobs more precarious, and their incomes more precarious. So it's going to be a major challenge. I don't think it can be solved by special interest group solutions. I think it's going to take something that lifts the whole society, not something that just does something for immigrants or something that does something for one group or another group. In any event, major policy challenges, I think, await us for the future. I'll quit on that note. All questions, comments, diatribes, disagreements. I just hope nobody wants to go outside and fight, which is what I. I thought the Stinson-Brenner bill really graphically demonstrated the contradictions that, you know, and when it, on the one hand we want and we seek immigrant labor, but you know, on the other hand, we want, you know, he was proposing to criminalize it, and the response was entirely appropriate, you know, and misunderstood, widely misunderstood, it seemed to me. Lots of people said, oh, look at all these demonstrations and all these waving of Mexican flags. These are people who don't want to be Americans. And at least my response is, well, I don't think that's it at all. I think these are people who don't want to be viewed as criminals when they're doing a lot of scut work.